Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We should have no more regulation than the health, safety, and security of the American people require. Every rule should meet that common sense test.
President Obama, who is due to speak shortly about deficit reduction with the Buffett rule we were talking about with Congressman Bob Turner, and we'll hear more about that coming up and excerpts from the president's presentation. But what we just played there was from that big job speech he gave before a joint session of Congress a week or so ago. The idea is that we would get more jobs if we lift the burden of unnecessary regulation off the back of businesses. That was part of his jobs bill. Virginia Congressman and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor put out his list of the top 10 job-killing regulations late last month, which included regulations for boilers, cement, and coal ash, not probably what you walk around Brooklyn or Queens or Newark or wherever thinking about, unless you work in one of the affected industries. Of course, figuring out which rules keep us safe and which ones fail the common sense test is easier said than done. And that's the kind of problem that my next guest specializes in. Philip K. Howard is the founder and chair of Common Good and the author of Life Without Lawyers and The Death of Common Sense, How Law is Suffocating America. He worked with Vice President Al Gore in reinventing government, as they called it, during the Clinton administration, their approach to streamlining rules and regulations back in the 90s. He's advised Republicans, too, and he has some ideas for fixing regulations today, and wrote about it recently for Forbes. Welcome back to WNYC, Philip K. Howard.
Good morning.
Where do you start in finding regulations that can't pass the common sense test? We'll go down some of the list of Eric Cantor's 10 worst regulations, but are there certain principles that you start by applying?
Yeah, there are principles, but neither party is applying them. So The Republicans all say we should deregulate, and Michelle Bachmann says we should get rid of EPA, and Cantor has his list of 10 regulations, as if we're regulating the wrong goals. That's actually incorrect. I mean, you can't live in a modern society without regulations on pollution, fair markets, whether toys have lead paint on them. You know, you need regulation more in a crowded, global, anonymous economy than you did, you know, in an agrarian economy.
And let's take an example of that. His number two top 10 job-destroying regulations is called the it's got all this alphabet soup in it, but Utility MACT, M-A-C-T, and C-S-A-P-R, blah. But what it is, in Cantor's words, a cross-state air pollution rule, right, for utility plants that will affect electricity prices for nearly all American consumers. So his concern is rising utility prices. I guess whoever wrote this regulation, their concern is public health because of air pollution from utility plants that crosses state lines. So, I mean, they're both right to be concerned about each of those things. And then the question that's mind-numbing for most lay people is, how do we balance those two common goods?
Well, that particular rule, the experts say that it yields $120 to $280 billion in annual health benefits starting in the year 2014. That's just around the corner.
And that's dollar figure on the health care costs that will not be needed because people won't get sick as much?
Yes. Avoid tens of thousands of premature deaths because of the reduction in pollution. So that happens to be, according to Republican environmental experts who I consulted about it, one of the most efficient rules being proposed.
So why does the House Majority Leader come out against that and put it on his top 10 worst regulations list?
For the same reason that people keep on keep arguing for low gas taxes. Well, in fact, we should be discouraging profligate use of energy and gasoline by phasing in some sort of carbon tax or higher tax. So they're just going for short-term economic benefits for whomever, which does have short-term economic benefits, but unfortunately it has longer-term economic costs. Yeah. And so you need to look at regulation. I mean, there are lots of regulations that I think go too far, and we can talk about those. But you can't just, quote, deregulate and solve the problem. nor can you do what Obama suggested, which is prune stupid regulations. They went through this massive exercise with his brilliant head of regulation, Cass Sunstein, and they came up with a grand total of $2 billion a year of savings out of a almost $2 trillion a year regulatory budget. That's 0.1%. That's not going to do anything for anybody. And if you circle back to the American people or small business and ask what they find wrong with regulation, it drives them crazy. It's stupid. They fill out forms nobody reads. It takes them months to get approvals. The regulators are inconsistent. It shuts down lemonade stands. You know, it does, you know, regulation truly is broken, but not for the reason either side is discussing.
Listeners, if you own or just work in a business that's regulated by government, and that's just about all businesses in one way or another, but if you come in touch with the impact of that regulation, give us a call and talk about it. What rules and regulations at the federal level or even local level do you think are good, productive, serve a purpose? Which ones are just stupid and cause you and the people you work with to sit with their brow furrowed and fill out all kinds of paperwork all the time that should be unnecessary, or move things around in your plant that, you know, you shouldn't have to move around, whatever. Good regulation, bad regulation, in your experience, in your government-regulated business. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Philip K. Howard. Do regulations get so specific that it's easy to judge compliance?
No, they're so specific that nobody can know them all. There are 180 million words of binding federal law and regulation and billions of words of state regulation. It's like the tax code run amok. I mean, no one could possibly know every rule, and that's one of the main problems with it. It's become central planning. It doesn't really matter what makes sense. It matters whether you, quote, comply with a rule, but the rules are so dense that literally nobody can comply with it. So if you're a mean-spirited government inspector, and I don't suggest that most are, you can find noncompliance in any workplace or any home in America. I mean, it's just the law is way too specific. And so that's part of the problem, which is that we got this idea that regulation should tell people exactly how to live their lives, and that's not really – it's really supposed to avoid bad things by and large. It should proscribe. You should not have unsafe working conditions, but you shouldn't have thousands of rules, as OSHA, the Worker Safety Agency, does, telling people exactly how to configure their factory.
Any of Eric Cantor's 10 worst government regulations that would make your own list?
Well, I mean, one of them is not a regulation. It's certainly his complaint about the NLRB decision to ban Boeing from building a plant in South Carolina.
That's his number one. The National Labor Relations Board, Boeing rule, as he calls it, forbidding Boeing from transferring an assembly line from Washington State to South Carolina.
Well, it's building a new assembly plant. I mean, I think that's really stupid. You shouldn't be businesses ought to have the freedom to make economic decisions about where to make their investments. So, you could throw a dart at any rule book, any one of them, and find, if not a stupid goal, the stupid implementation of a goal. Going back to OSHA, there's a specific rule that says that stairwells must be lit by natural or artificial light. Well, you can also have a rule that coffee cups should not be more than, 1 inch from the counter. You can have a rule for everything in life, but what that does is just divert people away from the focus, which should be safety, to complying with thousands of trivial suggestions by bureaucrats about how to set up a factory.
So whoever wrote that rule would probably say, this is a basic safety issue in the workplace. If you have a stairwell, it's got to be lighted somehow.
Sure, but you could have a rule that said workplaces shall be reasonably safe, tools and equipment shall be reasonably suited for the use intended in accord with industry standards, and give government inspectors the power to go in and say, hey, you've got a dark stairwell, I'm writing you up. You don't need a rule that says that. you know, human beings can deal with unsafe conditions. If you have the rule, just like having all these forms that nobody reads, what happens is you divert massive amounts of energy to compliance with the rules instead of focusing on safety, which, by the way, is mainly about a culture of safety. It's about training and really valuing safety. And the studies show that OSHA makes no has no positive effect on worker safety overall. I mean, there have actually been...
The whole agency?
The whole agency over the years. And the reason is not because it doesn't do a lot of good things. It's because the way it does it actually diverts people from doing other good things.
OSHA, of course, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, part of the federal government. We're talking about good and bad regulation with Philip K. Howard and Aaron and Teaneck. You're on WNYC. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Good morning. I think it's a super topic. I completely agree. I really think the issue is our regulations don't what our ultimate outcome is. If it's a dangerous or could be dangerous industry, then safety is important, like oil and gas. If it's the banking industry, then a prudential, you know, high capital requirements. I mean, and you know, every industry kind of has its key driver, its key metric. But if they complied with that, that becomes far more important to the success and safety or the overall prudentialness of that industry. I mean, if we knew BP complied with 500,000 regulations, but ultimately had unsafe strategic practices, do we really care, or do we that the big strategic things are incredibly safe and the compliance with the hundreds of thousands of minute details, you know, are just something that are guidance-based?
Philip?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think one of the problems with this central planning model is it does divert people away from the goal. So in general, what we need to do is rehumanize regulation. We need to give people responsibility to meet the public goals like safety and give authority, bounded authority, to government officials to try to enforce that and have an imperfect world, but that at least is focused on the ultimate goal, which is safety.
Charles in Clifton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Charles.
Gentlemen, I appreciate the topic. I want to say generally I am in favor of regulations. I don't think that the profit motive would get people engaged in thinking about society's goods. We have a small business, a law firm, and we built a building. We essentially bought a shell of a building and built it out for our practice, which was growing. And on the second floor, we had to put in a wheelchair-accessible bathroom, although because it was only a two-floor building, we didn't have to have an elevator or any kind of access going up to that floor. And to get a waiver would have taken 6 or 8 or 10 months because they've underfunded these agencies. So I spent a few hundred dollars extra. You could say it's frustrating. I believe with the overall goal of giving disabled people an opportunity to be to have an accessible workforce or an accessible public spaces, and I'm okay with that. But at the end of the day, that's the type of stuff that, as you're reading this list from the Republicans about the things they want to point to, I want a regulated world. I just bought a nice house for my family. I don't want the guy next door putting a nightclub or an auto mechanic shop there. It's zoned. It's in a particular neighborhood. And if you give people the opportunity just to run off the profit motive, people are not going to think about the larger good and everybody involved in the day-to-day in society.
Right. Essentially, you know, a crowded society, you're absolutely right, requires traffic cops all over the place, regulatory traffic cops. You've got to have them. But raising the disabled laws actually raises another flaw of modern regulation. There's this assumption that there's a kind of perfect society that you can make, and you can be completely fair so that the disabled have access to everything. So you have people building disabled accessible bathrooms at the top of ski mountains and things like that, which are probably not, you know, practical and not useful, or more economic cost, requiring every kitchen in an urban environment to have a turnaround space, someone in a wheelchair. I actually think it's really important to have a certain percentage of apartments in a building be wheelchair accessible. It's really important to have everyone be wheelchair accessible. Special ed laws. Who's against special ed law? We need to take care of special needs children. It was a scandal back in Willowbrook, you know, when they discovered that these kids were just locked away and treated horribly. But the law doesn't leave any room for balance. So now special ed laws consume 20% of the total K-12 budget in this country. Less than one half of 1% goes for programs for gifted children. It's way out of whack because of a regulatory system that doesn't give officials the authority to balance.
By the way, Charles, I'm guessing that your law firm does not do personal injury work?
No, actually, I mean, we don't do personal injury. We do a lot of employment law, and we have disabled people, and we set up a place for them on the first floor. We have a ramp and a place for people. So we were able to make that decision on the ground to get this waiver and save a couple hundred bucks for the bigger door and the bars and the bathroom. Would have taken too much time, so we spent the money. At the end of the day, I am generally just someone who's in favor of letting the disabled engage in society's day to day.
But not having to put a disabled-friendly bathroom on a floor that they couldn't even get to while you are accommodating them on the first floor. Charles, thank you for your call, and we're going to have to leave it there with Philip K. Howard. You want to say a last word, maybe aimed at the president, since he now has promised to do another review of government regulations to help create jobs?
Yeah, I mean, we're at the, you know, one of these moments in society where we need to rethink, like the 1960s, when we need to rethink how we do things. And I think that what's happened is that everyone, starting with people in government, teachers and others, and officials, have lost the authority to make sense of daily choices. So we need to create regulation as an open framework where we give people, starting in government, the authority to do their jobs and meet their goals and get away from a central planning model that has spawned, among other things, the Tea Party. So let's get away with polarization and start talking about right and wrong and daily choices, and that's an overhaul.
Philip K. Howard, author of books including Life Without Lawyers and The Death of Common Sense. His group, he is the founder and chair of, is called Common Good. You can see them at commongood.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, revisiting the human papillomavirus and the mandate for girls to get it. Yet again, this has come up in the Republican debates. We did two segments on it in the last week. And the more we think we know, the more we discover that we don't know. So we'll take another look at who is mandated to receive the human papillomavirus vaccine and some of the health controversies that we haven't touched on yet. Stay with us.